on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. I'm Bob. This is Conversation Radio. Radio like no other. No other anywhere. A 5 year long and counting conversation among you, me, us, we, ordinary folks. With extraordinary ideas. Because of the nature of the conversation we got into last night, I missed out on a lot of prayer meeting Wednesday fun, so we'll probably catch up with some of that tonight. Because there's serious stuff and seriously silly stuff. But I do not wish to... I've done this for a lot of years. And somehow it means something to me. I hope it does to you as well. This is 11-11. This is 11-11. It is the 11th day of November. At 11 a.m. this morning, I took a couple of minutes and just sat silently. Because this is the day of remembrance. In fact, it's called Remembrance Day. I'm reminded by our buddy Robert in Australia. It's called Remembrance Day in a lot of other places in the world. We call it Veterans Day. But it was originally Armistice Day. It was the commemoration of the end of the First World War. That first great monumental bloodbath of the 20th century. That foolhardy enterprise in slaughter. You know, I don't think of myself as being an old guy, even though my kids are quite convinced that I am. That's their fault, they're kids. They think weak old bread is old. I'm 47, soon be 48. But because of the way things worked out, I had older parents who were Depression-era children. And I actually, in my childhood, got to meet World War I veterans. One was a great, great uncle. And when he came home from the Great War, he wasn't quite right. And for the rest of his life, which wound up being to a great age, hence me being able to meet him, he didn't do much. Just stayed on the farm that his daddy had built and worked at that and raised a couple of children. And he told me a little bit here and there about his experiences in the few... And, you know, I met the man maybe 3, 4, 5 times in my life in my childhood, and yet it made enough of an impression that I still remember him. Don't trust nobody but yourself, boy, he once said. And don't trust yourself too far. And the things that he had picked up and brought back to the hills with him, hearing him whistle and, even at his advanced age, sing the few lyrics to Mademoiselle of Armentier. It was quaint, but one begins to understand after a while why things like that stick with you. And, you know, maybe I was 8, 9. Having this old face look at me and say, "Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" Because they were all taught that, because if the answer was yes, you killed them. Those folks deserve remembering. And, you know, in this modern mechanized age, perhaps we're not as shocked, although perhaps that's a function of some failure in our own conscience and in our own brains. We're not as shocked and horrified, I don't think, as that generation was. They came from places where nothing moved faster than a horse could go. And they were thrust into a world where where artillery shells shrieked at more than the speed of sound. And they were what Gertrude Stein said, a lost generation. The poem that best defines that era was written by Wilfred Owen between the 8th of October 1917 and March of 1918. Poetry takes work. Wilfred Owen was killed exactly 1 week before the armistice was signed. He was a British soldier. He was crossing a canal when a German bullet found his head. The notice of his death was delivered to his mother in England, literally, as the bells were pealing the end of the war at 11 a.m. on November the 11th, 1918. He used as his starting point an old quote from Horace, "Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori." It is sweet and right to die for your country. Something that has been hung on to since Horace penned it. You've always got to make people feel good about getting slaughtered in war, whether it be defensive for literally the survival of the nation, or whether it be offensive like the rape of Iraq. Yeah, got to make... Well, we got to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. And such it was with that generation. And they learned a bitter lesson. And Wilfred Owen used that phrase, "Dulce et decorum est," as the title of his poem, and it is the signature poem that defines that madness. Wilfred Owen wrote, "Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstripped 5-9s that dropped behind. Gas! Gas! Quick, boys!" An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim, though the misty panes, dim through the misty panes and thick green light as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning, if in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil's sick of sin. If you could hear, at every jolt, the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. The old lie. And it's still old, and it's still a lie, and it is still being bruited and spread about, largely by people who haven't the guts themselves to serve and fight, and have never witnessed a horror of death like that, or like any other that happens upon a battlefield. The old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, because there is nothing sweet and there is nothing honorable in slaughter. Sometimes there is necessity, but sweet, sweet, I think not. I think not. So even if you didn't take a couple of minutes at 11 a.m. this morning, we'll take a couple of minutes now. And we will remember those fields of murderous slaughter. And that generation that is now entirely dead that fought it. Pro patria mori. 2 minutes. Remember, remember, for it is the doom of men that they forget. They forget. Let us not. Let us not. And so we go into the meat of the program this evening with a little one of those just defining moments of what it means to be a Republican, what it means to be a thief, what it means to be a burglar in the nation's treasury. We take you, of course, to Ohio, a story by the Associated Press. Headline, LaHood turns down Kasich request to keep rail money. Now, you may or may not know that across the country, a whole lot of right-wing gubernatorial candidates and teabagging gubernatorial candidates and whatnot, one of the things that they resisted most ferociously was one of those things that the Obama administration proposed and funded that was without doubt brilliant and without doubt badly needed. And we're talking about expanding passenger rail throughout the country. And it's been the incoming governor of Wisconsin said he didn't want anything to do with it. And Ohio said, well, John Kasich said, we're just not going to build it. It was supposed to be a rail project that would create just normal, regular speed passenger service between Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Columbus. Somehow that seems like a pretty good idea, doesn't it? But not if you're a teabagger. Kasich has promised to cancel the project. He says the state can't afford it. How can the state not afford it if the feds are paying for it? No, what he is, he's a little pissant baby who wants to funnel the money to his right-wing cronies in the freight industry. You know, we don't need no passenger rail. Well, give a teabagger one thing, if nothing else. They are made of solid brass. Because John Kasich contacted the Obama administration Department of Transportation and asked Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, he said, well, we're not going to build that boondoggle railroad, but we'd sure enough like to keep all them millions that you're going to spend on it. Which instantaneously transforms John Kasich into, well, a burglar, a thief, a con artist, a confidence man. Because on the one hand, he said, and a liar, don't forget liar. It's okay to call them liars when they lie. He said they couldn't afford it, and yet at the same time, even though they couldn't afford it, he wants to keep the money that he wasn't going to have to spend in the first place. He wants to use the money for roads and freight lines. Well, you know, we'll have a transportation bill for that. Well, that is if the teabag in Congress will let us. But can you imagine the brass, the nerve, the unmitigated gall of contacting the transportation secretary and saying, well, that Kenyan Muslim got us a bunch of millions of dollars for building a railroad, but we don't want no railroad. What we want instead is to spend it on our contractor buddies who are out there building roads and running the freight lines. We could build some freight rail, just no passenger rail. But we want, please, can I please keep the money so I can steal it and give it to my buddies and they can kick it back to me? Oh, please, pretty please, I want the money. And Ray LaHood, bless his heart, said, sorry, no train, no money. We'll give it to somebody else that actually wants rail service, and you can answer to the, you can answer to the voters of Ohio. Who might have liked to have been able to get at reasonably decent prices from, say, Cincinnati to Cleveland a lot more quickly than they could have gotten there driving. Yeah, you tell them why you didn't want it. Do that, why don't you? God, they really are. They're thieves. We can't afford it. But you've given us the money, and that means that we can't afford it, but we could afford to use it to pave some roads for more trucks to tear up. Of course, that'd be real good with my right wing contractor buddies who would get the money. Because see, at the bottom line, it would, you know, the passenger rail service would likely become part of the Amtrak system, and that's socialism. Don't want no money that, you know. You can almost hear John Kasich saying, I just I just want to wet my beak. All I want to do is wet my beak. Just want to get my beak wet. That's how they are. Last night on the program, I shared with you the information from Representative Shimkus of Illinois, who said that God promised he would not destroy the earth again, and therefore that means there's no such thing as global warming. Reasoning like that is akin to, using a Ouija board for a roadmap. Using the Bible to determine climate policy is like using a Ouija board for a roadmap. If I leave now driving to Charleston, will I get there if I go via Wheeling? Well, the answer is going to come back, yes, but it's going to take you a lot longer. See what I mean? But that's okay. He's not the only loon who's going after the chair of the Energy Committee. There's another loon. This loon's name is Joe Barton of Texas. We've talked about Joe in the past. Joe is so thoroughly bought by the energy industries that he can scarcely go to the bathroom without the permission of the CEO of ExxonMobil. This is the same Joe Barton who apologized to BP after BP toxified the Gulf Coast and, don't tell anybody, but oil carcinogens are showing up in Gulf shrimp. Bastards. The one thing on this earth, food-wise, that I probably love above all others, fresh royal reds out of the Gulf, and BP has poisoned them. But Joe Barton has gone further than simply apologizing to BP in terms of lunacy. He says, this is one of those places where history is kind of dangerous if you don't know anything about it. He says, Joe Barton does, that he wants to be chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee because his hero is Davy Crockett. Wait a minute. We got to do something here. Here we go.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, green estate in the land of the free, raised in the woods so he knew every tree, killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
Yes, indeedy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier and hero of Joe Barton, who said, one of my heroes is a guy named Davy Crockett. He fought a fight that most people thought was hopeless. And one of Crockett's sayings is, be sure you're right, then go ahead. And then discussing the health care law, he said, the right thing to do is repeal this bill, and we're going to do it. How about that? Really? Charming, huh? Describing the need of the American people, millions, tens of millions upon tens of millions of them, one of whom is me, describing their need for access to simple basic health care, as a, what's that phrase? Yeah, hopeless battle. It's hopeless. Joe Barton is another member of that class of repiglickens who says, God bless America, we're the best nation in the world, and we can't hardly walk and breathe at the same time. We're so damn hopeless. We're hopeless. Says that right before he says the Pledge of Allegiance and sings the national anthem twice, you know. The story being quoted says he laid out the central fronts, the fight against the EPA, backing the growing insurgency opposed to net neutrality regulations, taking on environmental radicalism, and, of course, defending the traditional incandescent light bulb. I don't know. Let me look here. Yeah, okay, we're safe. John Fox is not in the chat room, so maybe he won't have to have an aneurysm when I get to this part. Because this would just not sit well with John. John would be running, grabbing at his hair, and round the house screaming, "Bloody hell!" Defending the traditional incandescent light bulb against government regulators who want to replace it with what Barton called the little squiggly pig-tailed ones. No, really. There's your incoming Republican majority. There's the guy who wants to head the Energy and Commerce Committee. Are we concerned about the fact that we're desperately in need of diversifying our energy grid portfolio in this? No. Are we concerned about the fact that there's a pandemic going on in Appalachia from people being poisoned by the after effects of mountaintop removal coal extraction? No. Those environmental radicalists are trying to take away your God-given right to a traditional incandescent light bulb. They want you to have them communist pig-tailed squiggly ones instead. Oh, Sparky is screaming. Good. Glad somebody's picking up John's slack. Thanks, Sparky. Why can't he defend the traditional whale oil hurricane lamp? That's antediluvian enough for Joe Barton. That's what we need, but oh God, don't give him any ideas. They'll want to go whaling. There is a tremendous source of oil out there, and it's swimming around in the ocean every day. And it's just them communists that keep us from going out and... One of Crockett's sayings is, be sure you're right, then go ahead. I'm guessing that Joe Barton doesn't understand that quote. It's got a dependent clause in it, but it's also got what you're taught if you ever have a cup of coffee in law school, what you're taught is a condition precedent. The condition precedent is, be sure you're right, then go ahead. The only thing Joe Barton can read is, go ahead! Go ahead! And protect that poor bedraggled incandescent light bulb. Oh, God. I can't imagine a world without incandescent light bulbs. Even though the squiggly pig-tailed ones last a whole lot longer. I got one here in the studio. Damn, that thing's bright. A third of the wattage. Be sure you're right, then go ahead. Because, see, Joe Barton is not right. He is factually wrong. He's not philosophically wrong. I don't have a philosophical difference with Joe Barton. I have a factual difference. This is one of those cases where just because there's two sides to an argument doesn't mean that both sides are equally valid. Joe Barton's side of the argument is patently insane. Are we square on this? The right thing to do is repeal this bill, and we are going to do it. The few people that are actually going to get health care access of some type, and I ain't one of them, well, the right thing to do is to make sure they don't get it, according to Joe Barton. And it's another one of those moments where you want not enough money, not enough time, and the old rusty red pickup truck just isn't up to the trip. I really would. One of these days, I'd like to dedicate a year to just traveling around to congressional districts and door knocking. Hi, my name's Bob. Did you know that your congressman is Joe Barton? Well, yes, I do. He's a great American. Do you know that he thinks that compact fluorescent light bulbs are communism?
Well, I do, too.
Oh, good. Well, I'm done. My work is done. I just wanted to meet the kind of moron that thinks that he's getting good representation by from a guy who's been bought off by the various and sundry industries that buy off Republican congressmen. Good day to you, sir. It wouldn't be. Because the urge would be, you idiot! I just came to look at you. That's all. That's all I got. I'm a happy and healthy man now, and I may go happily about the rest of my days, for I have seen the kind of idiot that puts Republicans in office. You know, I say that half in jest, but I also say it half in truth. Because the people who object to the likes of Joe Barton in their district, who rallies them? Who rallies them is there any kind of cohesive resistance? If I lived in Joe Barton's district, this is a hypothetical, I would try to find me some like-minded people, and we'd have an agreement that every one of us, and we'd try to grow the group as big as possible, hopefully at least 30 people, one person, and we'd just set it down on the calendar, okay, Fred, you do it on the 1st, I'll do it on the 2nd, Bill, you do it on the 3rd, Mary Jane, you do it on the 4th, and every day a different person writes a letter to the editor decrying Joe Barton and just wailing with the shame of having that district represented by a goddamned idiot. If you put that kind of stuff out there and you can actually get it into print, eventually you will begin to have some success. And then again, there's just plain history. Joe Barton doesn't know squat about Davy Crockett. He doesn't know that Davy Crockett was a Democrat. He doesn't know that Davy Crockett, for his time, was a liberal. Now, there's a verse in the song, the old Disney song. Here it comes.
Fought single-handed through the Injun War till the Creeks was whipped and peace was in store. And while he was handling this risky chore, made himself a legend forevermore. Davy, Davy Crockett, the man who don't know fear.
No, he didn't know fear, but he did know morals, and he did know conscience, and he had one, and it was very active, and it got him in a lot of trouble. You know, he was fighting underneath Andrew Jackson when Andrew Jackson was down slaughtering Native Americans, basically in Alabama. Battle of Horseshoe Bend comes to mind. And David Crockett quickly became disillusioned with the slaughter of the natives. No coward. He did what he was told to do. But he became quickly disillusioned. Because he saw why it was happening and how it was happening. And he objected to it. He was, yes, really, not kidding, a liberal. Has anybody told Joe Barton that Davy Crockett was a liberal? Because he was. David Crockett went on to be elected to the Congress from the district in Middle Tennessee that contains Lawrence County, whose county seat is Lawrenceburg, about 43 miles up U.S. 43 from where I grew up, and there's a Davy Crockett State Park there because he was born there. Either born there or lived there. I can't remember which. I don't want to get stuff wrong. I don't want to lie to you. Even inadvertently. But he went to Congress. And he was in the Congress at the time when Andrew Jackson, as president, was espousing his idea of what was essentially a genocide of the Native Americans. I mean, it just was. He was going to remove them by force and clean out the entire southeastern United States and send them all off to Oklahoma or something. We know it as the Trail of Tears. And without getting into too much detail, David Crockett. David Crockett had the courage, and it's the kind of courage in the modern era that we saw when Dennis Kucinich stood up and introduced articles of impeachment against Dick Cheney. David Crockett, almost alone, voiced profound opposition to the genocide that Andrew Jackson had planned for the Native Americans, because Andrew Jackson hated Indians. He hated them openly. He had, and it was a function of his life. But he had no compunction against the wholesale mass murder of Indian peoples. And David Crockett opposed him. And for those of us who naively think that politics has only become ugly in, since like 1980 and the dirty tricks of the Republicans in the 1970s under Nixon, wrong. Andrew Jackson marshaled every bit of political power he had to utterly destroy David Crockett. And succeeded. And that's why Crockett was kind of out and about and not a lot to do, and wound up marching off to Texas with his band of volunteers. You know, to defend the rights of squatters in Texas, white slave-owning squatters, to own human flesh, contrary to the laws of the nation in which they lived, to wit, Mexico, which long before and without a vast bloodletting, I mean, there was bloodletting, but not on nearly the scale that was yet coming to the United States. Mexico had outlawed human bondage and human slavery. And David Crockett went down there to defend the rights of white folks to own black folks in Mexico. And that's where he died and became a national hero. Yeah, John Fox, you're right. Joe don't know diddly. He don't know diddly about climate. He don't know diddly about policy. He don't know diddly about the sufferings of tens of millions of uninsured Americans, thousands of whom die every year for want of access merely to that insurance. And he don't know diddly about history. Joe Barton is dumber than a big old bag of homemade stupid. Now, our pop culture correspondent, David from Maine, says this is a great song for Joe Barton for the break. So let's take that break and find out. I'm trusting you, David. Here we go. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn.
The sun is a light bulb. The candle's a tree. The curtains stay closed now on my little retreat. And I only take medicine if it's followed by sweets. I sickly pinkly quit. That puts me to sleep. My head keeps on burning away. Tomorrow a better day.
Like I watch TV while I'm wrapped up in bed.
Oh, I've got a new band to investigate. Porcupine Tree. You know, I think I need to, like, re-up my subscription to Rolling Stone or something. And that's probably, like, geezery to even say Rolling Stone, right? Porcupine Tree, Lightbulb Sun. Great call. Great call, David from Maine. News Ninja Gene saying, you're a better man than I am, Bob. If I was standing close to a GOP voter, I'd have to hit him. It's a struggle. Beth in Dallas just wrote in, and she said, I loved your tribute to the veterans of that brutal great war to end all wars. All day I've been remembering my great-grandfather, John Luther Bowles, and my grandfathers, Emmett Lander Lister and Charles Taggart Christian. While they were not fated to die for their country, even as a child, I could understand that parts of their immortal souls had remained behind with those who did die when they left Flanders and all those other fields of glory to come home. I will always be grateful that they did come home when so many others did not. Thank you for remembering them tonight. Thank you, Beth. Those little acts of memory are the only thing we have approaching immortality. Oh, even, you know, even with the phony baloney fake Christians and so forth who think that they're going to walk on streets paved with gold, they think that that's immortality? What's immortal on planet Earth about somebody who's so gone you can't even remember their names? So, Beth, the fact that you remember the names and that you remember that the names had lives attached to them, you are the guardian. You are the guardian of their immortality. One of my grandfathers was not allowed to fight in the Great War because it turned out he had a heart problem. So instead, he stayed here and built a little business and got destroyed by Republicans in the process. But eventually his heart did kill him. My other grandfather served in the First World War, and we to this day have a photo of him in old black and white, gone sepia tonish with age, of him standing ramrod straight with his puttees done in his doughboy uniform. We forget, as I said, at our peril. Now, you know the number. This is Conversation Radio. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877-4, head on. On your nickel, it's 304-658-3333. Chime right in. Email comes in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hey, Susan.
My grandfather was gassed in World War One. He didn't quite die then. He lasted quite a few years, but his lungs and his health were never quite the same. And he hated two nationalities virulently till the day he died. One, of course, was the English. He was a Scot. And the other was the Germans. I kind of, you know, I understood the hatred of the Germans because they'd come perilous close to killing him. They did kill a whole lot of his friends.
Well, my father, from the Second World War, Susan, was hopelessly bigoted against the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't think very kindly of the Germans either.
Yeah, Donald, till the day he died, the war affected him. He served in both World War II in the Pacific and in Korea, and till the day he died, he could never watch a war movie. Even those very, very hokey, you know, propaganda ones. Let's not even begin to talk about the realistic jobs, you know. Like Band of Brothers. Couldn't do it. Because the older he got, the more the PTSD started to come out.
it could lay dormant for eons or near it.
Yeah. And, you know, the longer we were married, the more I could see it affect him. He would never talk about it except for some of the silly things that happened, you know, like when he was in the States. But never, you know, never, he would never discuss his combat experience. No, wouldn't talk about it, ever. So, the guys who went out and were shot at, as far as I'm concerned, this country treats them shamefully.
It does.
And the Republicans in particular step on them with gleeful abandon. Donald and I fought the VA for over a decade trying to get him a hearing aid, because when he was in Korea, he lost part of his hearing due to a battle called Operation Thunderbolt. These great big guns for over a mile and then have him sleep right next to them and have them go off for over an hour, it's going to affect your hearing. But he could not prove it. So for over a decade, they said, no, it's not service connected. It was not until the ever demonized Nancy Pelosi, 110th Congress, and Barack Obama came into office and funded the VA, all of a sudden he was fitted for hearing aids. Now, he died before he could get his final fitting, but there's hundreds of thousands of soldiers who are getting treated now because of Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi and the 110th Congress, when they would have been told, go away. And maybe people should think about that the next time you talk to a veteran who is thinking about killing himself or who needs medicine. Or maybe you should think about that the next time you run across a freaker who starts yammering on about socialism. Well, yeah, give me some more. It works.
Well, they're going to, you know, there's no getting around, Susan, the fact that they're going to try to do their damnedest to kill what is left of the social safety net in this country. If you look at the Cat Food Commission proposal that says what? The retirement age goes up to 69 in 2050. You know, what a sleazy, sneaky, bastardy way to go about it. Because there's nobody, Susan, who can vote. Very few. What they're doing is they're playing with the future of people who will not be able to do anything to them because they're going to be dead. I think one of the fundamental flaws in the Cat Food Commission was having two geezers run it.
Yeah. I think one of the things that just really makes me crazy is like today I was watching some guy, he was saying he was going on about austerity. You're just going to have to bite the bullet. Okay. Guys, with my husband's death, my income is going to drop to just over $12,000 a year. What do I cut? My heat or my food? Tell me. I want to know.
See, that's the problem, Susan, and I'm not trying to be an ass.
They don't give a rip.
They don't care.
No.
I keep saying it on this program, and, you know, maybe, you know, I never know how people respond unless I get an email or a phone call or something like that. But I fear that sometimes people think, you know, that's just Bob, and he's just being a little bit over the top. And, you know, he's just saying that because it sounds... No. This program is not entertainment. maybe it's entertaining once in a while, but it's not entertainment. You know that, Susan. I do, too. We all do, I hope. It's not designed to be entertainment. It's designed to be informative. It's designed to be expressive. It's designed to be conversational. But I'm not trying to entertain anybody when I say they want it all. And no matter what you or anybody else can bring up in this country, the answer as far as the GOP is concerned is they want it all. See, they don't want you to have to live on $10,000 a year instead of 12, or 6 instead of 12. They want it all. And they don't care what happens to you or to anyone else.
They want what was in effect in the reign of Queen Victoria, where people, in order to eat, sold their children, sold their bodies, and starved anyway. But boy, the aristocracy lived high. And of course, we're totally above the law.
So, you know, let's just drive that. Let's beat on it. They want it all. If there is a penny floating around that the right wing and their owners in the corporate oligarchy, the corporatocracy, the corporatist state, if there is a dime, a penny laying around that they don't have, they want it.
Yep.
I mean, this is I'm beating on this because it's short, it might not stick. I want it to stick. I don't want anybody to ever look at a Republican proposal without thinking they want it all.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason they talk about cutting taxes is because they want that too.
Yeah.
John Kasich in Ohio doesn't want to build any daggum roads. He wants the money.
I mean, exactly. When that story first broke, I posted it on Huffington Post. On the story, I posted a comment. I said, hey, that's fine. Give the money, send the money over to the left coast. We'll put in a nice high-speed line between L.A. and Seattle and just make money hand over fist.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, you know it.
You know, I'd love to be able to get on a train around here and reasonably go somewhere in a period of time that would rival flight. It would be so much nicer. But I was listening to the Rick Smith show last night, and apparently the Repiglickens are after the sleeper cars on Amtrak now.
Of course. They're after everything.
There. Say it with me, Susan. One, two, three.
They're after everything.
No. What's our phrase? We've been working. Yeah, one, two, three. They want it all. They don't want some of it.
Want it.
They don't want most of it. They want it all.
And they want it now.
And they want it now.
Exactly. Yes. Gee, where have I heard that before? Freddie Mercury. It just, you know, these people just blow me away. But you take the smallest thing from them and listen to them squeal.
Yeah, that's the thing. They want it all from us, but if we want a little from them, they squeal like they're being skinned alive.
I mean, it sounds like you're butchering a hog. Actually, I rather like it listening to him squeal. But, you know, trying to get the power to take anything from them is a little difficult. Because we are not the types, unlike these creeps, who are going to go out and hunt them down. The thing is, if they keep pushing, sooner or later, they're going to run into the historical fact that Nicholas II ran into and Louis XVI ran into. You can only push people so far.
See, that's where I'm not so sure that you're correct. A fascist state, and I want to go through this slowly because I want to get it right. Fascist states almost never fall from within. Because a fascist state has its citizenry so thoroughly under their thumb. And let me add, comfortably under their thumb, that revolution is almost impossible. Fascist states only fall when they are taken down from outside.
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is, that's the deal, the comfortably under their thumb.
Well, you know what? Susan, America is quite comfortable. I mean, we've got millions out of work. We've got people being thrown out of their homes. We've got people for whom I read a story earlier today, for whom getting a roll of their own toilet paper at the homeless shelter is cause for celebration. That exists in America.
Yep.
Texas alone has millions, literally millions, of uninsured that the Governor Rick Goodhair Perry doesn't give a fig about.
Yep.
But you know what? The cable is still on. The internet is still working. And WWE and Ultimate Fighting and Dancing with Bristol Palin are still broadcast at their regularly scheduled time.
Mm-hmm.
The beer is still on the shelves, and the liquor is still down to the liquor store.
Right. The thing is, what will topple a fascist state is sooner or later something from outside will provide a trigger. And then the barbarians come to the gates of Rome.
And that in itself is a horror, because of all the nation states out there, the ones that fall the most brutally and inflict the most hell and damnation on their innocent citizenry, to the extent that they're innocent, are fascist states. Because when a fascist state finally falls, with the exception of Spain, there are usually profound piles of rubble and ruins in their wake.
Not to mention the body count.
You know, Spain. When Generalissimo Francisco Franco finally died and stayed dead.
Yep.
That nation began to peaceably transition. But they did theirs. They did theirs on the front end with the Civil War. And anyone who has ever seen Picasso's Guernica.
Yeah.
Gets a sense for how awful that was.
Yeah, the body. You're going to get the body count one way or the other. Be it the front end or the back end. But you're going to get it, be it Germany, Spain, or whatever. Now, the trick is arranging things so that you can survive it. Now, if you happen to be in Appalachia, you've got a shot. Because those hills, hell, you can wander back in those hills and disappear.
You can't disappear that good.
Yeah, but you can do it pretty good, and that's all you need, because once the basic government goes down, all you got to do basically is learn how to live on your own, and let's face it, nobody knows how to live on his own better than a hillbilly, right?
Yeah, but the places that we would go to do all that are toxic now, Susan.
Yeah.
You can't drink the water. You can't breathe the air. The soil itself has been toxified.
Maybe you
we're all no. We have troubles. We all have troubles in this country that we have not begun to even contemplate.
Oh yeah, I know. But the trick is to figure out. When do you think this is going to collapse? And because think what you will. This civilization is oh so very fragile.
Oh, it's tissue paper thin.
Yeah. It's nothing like Rome. Rome could stagger on for centuries.
1,000 years.
Now, if nothing else, the people of Rome could end up eating the cats. And they did. Several times. And, you know, they got by. But this one, all it would take is one set of massive unrest. And no, to the people who are listening, I am not advocating that. I am just stating, hey, we got problems here. All it would take is one great big set of massive unrest. The whole grid shuts down. And within 24 hours, the cities are uninhabitable. And that's when it's going to get really bad. You know, those old 1950s Holocaust movies, you know, where it showed all the people madly trying to get out of the cities? That was one of the few parts of those movies that was true to life.
But, you know, most people don't think, Susan, about their precarious position, because otherwise, because it would render them functionally unable to get through any given day.
Yeah, if you want to read a book that, A, is a good book, and B, although it's somewhat dated because it involves the Soviet Union, but that has something along this lines, it's a book called Alas, Babylon. You could probably find it in your local library.
Sounds like a good read.
It's scary.
Well, Susan, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and you have yourself a wonderful evening, dear.
Well, I shall endeavor.
Or as wonderful as may be had.
Yeah, and thanks for all your help, hon.
My pleasure, Susan.
The horn is helping me to stay sane. Get awful quiet here.
I understand. You hang in.
Okay. Bye, hon. And my love to Agnes.
I sure will. And our love back. Bye now. News Ninja Susan calling from Oregon. An email just came in, and haven't had one of these in quite a long while. I was just tickled pink to get it. And this is a perspective I think needs to be considered as we look at the recommendations of the Cat Food Commission. Cassie. Intrepid Princeton freshman. She's there. She's busting her butt. Intrepid Princeton freshman Cassie says, the problem is that people my age don't know the difference between age 65 and age 69. They're both just old. Way old. Most of us are still in school or just started working, more than triple our current age. So we aren't set up to fight for our retirement. And Cassie says, no offense to people past 60. I don't think the people past 60 are offended, Cassie, because they too were once your age as well. And a lot of them in their minds, well, that's the thing. You get a little wiser with age, but if you take care of your brain, it's still easy to remember what it was like to be young with a world in front of you. But I think if you want to talk for a minute on how Cassie's generation should maybe approach this cat food commission business, I think it's another one of those three-word bumper stickerable things. How dare you? How dare you? How dare a couple of paper-skinned, wizened old geezers like Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, how dare they talk about what Cassie's generation may or may not have? How dare they? How dare they? And it's that simple. You know, after all of the yes we can that we got in 2008, maybe Cassie's generation needs to stand up and say, no, you can't. Because we're not talking here about some sort of simple actuarial formula. We're talking about a sentence. These are sentences. Cassie's generation is going to be sentenced to work an extra 4 years and hope that they don't die before they get to the promised land of Social Security, which the Cat Food Commission says not only you're going to have to wait till 69, it's going to be less money, too. How dare they? You know, long before there was ever a teabagger, I was on the air during the Iraq War watching the debt mount up and asking, how dare they encumber my grandchildren with debt? Because at the time, back when the Bush administration was in, had the bit in their teeth and was in the heady thrills of murdering a nation that had done nothing to us, George Bush hung a $20,000 to $40,000 debt around the neck of every newborn life that came into being in this nation. All for an act of monumental ego. He tried to kill my daddy. Damn them! How dare they? Can we work with that a little bit? How dare they? How dare they? But, you know, there's another side to it as well. How dare they? They dare because we spend more time watching Dancing with Bristol Palin or Ultimate Fighting or Football on Sunday or the Oprah or The Daily Show or just about anything else than getting out and getting busy. William just wrote in and he said, yes, they want it all, and the sad part is if the people would stand together and just stop those who want it all, then they'd be starved out and in turn the people would win. Yet, here is the sad part. People need jobs and will do whatever is required to feed their families and themselves. We can no longer live off the land when the land is owned by someone. Not that I will see in the time I have left, but one day, they who want it all will end up as they who took it all. And everything has an end. William's right, there is a remedy. Organizing is the remedy. One person cannot stand up to the power of a corporate employer or even, you know, a mom-and-pop employer. One person can't do it. But a group standing together speaking with one voice can. Right? It ain't rocket science. So we'll take a little break. It's time for the Green News Report. And we will come back with your phone calls. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You are listening to Conversation Radio on the Horn.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, November 11th, Veterans Day, 2010.
Cholera spreading in Haiti. Halliburton in the fracking hot seat again. Veterans get Senate help for chemical exposure. Plus...
Look, folks, there's a lot more we can do to save energy, to free us from oil, and to create jobs.
Vice President Biden talks sexy, sexy energy efficiency.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
The whole idea of man-made global warming is a hoax.
Yes, Rush, and if you say it over and over and over and over again on our public airwaves, that just might make it true.
Even after they are exposed as frauds, they keep it up, they ratchet it up.
Well, on that part, we can agree. This is your Green News Report. The Green News Report is sponsored by you, yes, you. We, unlike Rush Limbaugh, tell the truth over your public airwaves, but we need your support to do it. Please stop by our website, greennews.bradblog.com, and contribute to our efforts. Please stop on by, or you can PayPal to greennews@bradblog.com. We appreciate your support. Okay, Des, well, it's Veterans Day, so we send out our thanks to all of our veterans and their families, and, of course, to our future veterans who are now serving on active duty. And another note, we want to send our congrats to our colleagues Kate Shepard and Mac McClellan, both of Mother Jones, the crack environmental team over there. They've been honored by the Society of Professional Journalists for their brilliant coverage of the BP oil disaster in the Gulf. Well-deserved indeed. And both have been my guests, by the way, on the Mike Malloy program, which I will once again be guest hosting on Friday night. So I hope folks will tune in. What do you have for us today, Des?
Well, speaking of Veterans Day, a bipartisan coalition of senators is trying to get the military to take responsibility for veterans' illnesses related to chemical exposure. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont in a recent Senate Veterans Affairs Committee hearing.
The difficulty is that the world has changed very significantly as a result of chemical exposure. Let us not forget that when Agent Orange was first used, our friends at Dow and Monsanto and all of those companies, I said, this is benign. That's not a problem.
Just this week, a federal judge denied the Navy's request to dismiss a case brought by a woman with cancer who was one of over 500,000 people who were exposed to water contaminated with benzene and other toxic chemicals at Marine Base Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. The Navy, for decades, has fought even acknowledging the water at Camp Lejeune was contaminated, much less paying for treatment. The Veterans Affairs Committee is also working with the military over toxic burn pits where veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan were exposed to toxic substances burned by military contracting companies. Government officials in Haiti confirm that an outbreak of cholera has now spread to the capital city of Port-au-Prince due to flooding from Hurricane Tomas, and they are now bracing for an epidemic, says the Red Cross.
The concern now, specifically with cases now being confirmed within the city, is that the situation will really expand, and that's why agencies like the Red Cross are really dramatically increasing the support that they're trying to provide to communities.
So far, cholera has killed over 600 people and sickened thousands in Haiti. Halliburton is in the hot seat again. The Environmental Protection Agency has issued a subpoena to force Halliburton to reveal the chemicals it uses to drill for natural gas. Back in September, the EPA ordered natural gas drilling companies to list the chemicals they use in the controversial natural gas drilling technique known as hydraulic fracturing. Hydraulic fracturing, aptly known as fracking, for short, injects water and toxic chemicals under high pressure to push natural gas out of fractures in the bedrock. The EPA, under congressional order, is studying whether those chemicals are contaminating nearby wells. Every drilling company, except for Halliburton, has complied with the order. Halliburton says the EPA's request is too broad.
Fracking Halliburton.
It could be because Halliburton was caught using banned chemicals earlier this year. And finally, the United States could save billions in energy costs every single year if homes and buildings were retrofitted to stop wasting so much energy. So, why don't we? Well, multiple studies have shown that it's primarily due to a lack of access to information and financing. So to that end, Vice President Joe Biden, chairman of the Obama administration's middle class task force, this week announced a new federal program that will help homeowners retrofit their homes to be more energy efficient, the Recovery Through Retrofit program.
We believe that retrofitting homes has the potential to save us billions of dollars, and we believe that these projects that we are announcing today will go a long way toward growing an industry and in the process creating good jobs for a very good public purpose.
You know, it's not hot, it's not sexy, it doesn't make particularly good radio or media, but the fact is, you're right. The public does not know the truth. They are not aware of these points, and that goes back to our opening where we hear instead Rush Limbaugh using the public airwaves to lie to the people instead of inform them. But as they say, the truth is out there, and it happens to be today on our website at greennews.bradblog.com. If you're a homeowner or a building owner, please check it out to see what you may be able to do to help save money, help create jobs, and help save your world. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Home, where my pops are sleeping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently for me.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Minutes past the hour, this thorn in the side Thursday rolls on the horn, and I want to get right back to the phones. You know there's lines open, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Elaine just wrote in, and she said she read A Last Babylon when she was about 14, and then again in her 20s, and just a month ago or so, sent copies to her kids. She said, while its premises about nuclear holocaust is very prescient as the chaos and fight for survival afterwards. She said, I plan on being home tomorrow at this time and calling in. I just found out that my huge disability payments, she says it to me, so I figure I can share it with you. She says $700 a month plus $57 in food stamps is about to be bitten into even further. It seems our incoming Republican governor seems to think we need to pay more than the $10 copay for medical transportation. For folks like me, $25 a trip when you go to dialysis 4 days a week plus doctor's appointments is not going to be easy. She says, yes, I'm blessed with a family that can help out to some extent. Without them, I'd be in the streets. What about the millions, Elaine asks? What about the millions on disability or Social Security that don't have family help? Oh, and the incoming governor also wants everyone on disability to be recertified next year because of the rampant fraud and waste in our system. Elaine says, any idea what recert means for us? Not good. She also adds, I look forward to calling in and catching up. She says, keep up the incredible work. She says, I've even got my 85-year-old dad listening to Horvath's clips on YouTube. Says he gets a kick out of Sandra's calls. Have you subscribed at YouTube yet? Through Horvath's channel, H-O-R-V-A-C? If you do, you'll be getting regular update clips. And he even takes requests, I'm told. I was looking on my Facebook page earlier today, and Horst Bjorn Gobler. I don't know. Maybe that's a silent J. Maybe it's Born Gobler. Whatever. He says he takes requests, so if there's something that you hear that you think is clip-worthy, by all means, let him know via Facebook. Horvath. Horzak. H-O-R-Z-A-C. Horzak is the channel to subscribe to on YouTube in order to get frequently updated clips from the program that you can then pass around and share and swap for other clips. It's just like Pokemon, only liberal and radio. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Bob, good evening.
Hey, Jim.
How are you tonight?
I'm well, thank you. You?
Reasonably. I remember A Last Babylon. That was first read to me by my eighth grade teacher. And it came out in Look magazine. I think it was Look in a serialized version. And it did deal with nuclear war, and the setting was in Florida. And it described the effects of the bombs there, and even how the shapes of the lakes around Orlando had changed. And it dealt with one family, one of whom had built this beautiful home. And of course, the beautiful home didn't do them a whole lot of good because the power had been shut off, and one of the characters in the book was a woman named Lavinia, who was a diabetic. And because of lack of refrigeration over a month, 2 months period of time, she died because the insulin in the refrigerator or the freezer no longer had any effect. And how the freezers were filled with steak swimming in ice cream for lack of power. Total destruction of infrastructure. And so my heart goes out to Susan and for the loss of her husband. And also, in a true spirit of thankfulness, for his services in those two wars.
Thank you, Jim. I know that you mark this holiday with real remembrance.
Well, I sent you an email last night, and I'm going to read it to you if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
And I'll just abridge it and change it. And I'll say this. Today is Thank You Day. Thank you for your many services, sacrifices, valor, hardship, separation from loved ones, from any surroundings, and from lives previously known. For these men and women, duty is the most honorable word in our language. May God bless vets and their families on November 11th and every other day, with undying recognition and gratitude and respect. My signature.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear. The question, of course, is, you sincerely offer something like that, Jim. But there really are people in this country, there really are, who think so little of the people who have served in our military that they're willing to actually engage in what they consider to be sane conversations about privatizing VA hospital and medical services.
Oh, how well I know. I have had to deal with these people as a medical actions officer in dealing with VA and dealing with people in Washington trying to obtain health care for those people who have been wounded and exposed to diseases, chemicals, radiation used in munitions. Oh, I've been through the whole bag of horrors. And know exactly.
And so ultimately, what we find ourselves, and I suppose it's true of any culture, we are very good, and I don't mean you, because knowing you, I know the depth of sincerity of your offer. But this country is very good at especially the right wing and the Tea Partiers and so forth. They're very good at talking about how they respect veterans and how they support the troops, and they buy little Chinese yellow ribbon magnets to prove it and put it on the back of their gas-guzzling SUVs. But that's all it is lip service. Because for them, it's out of sight, out of mind. And I return to the thesis that Susan and I worked on, Jim. They want it all.
Well, they're not going to get it all. I don't believe they are. And people who want it all, a lot of times, end up with very little, if nothing. But I remember working for a bird colonel when I first started. And he told me, well, what do you think your position is? Are you trying to take care of these people or represent the government? You're supposed to represent the government. And that is your mandate. I bypassed that son of a bitch and went straight to the Pentagon. And I can guarantee you, no man suffered unnecessarily within the confines of my responsibility under my watch. And no health care was denied. It took a hell of a lot out of me. But I did not adhere to the marching orders given to me by an 06. Because I went right over him.
And I don't think there is anyone who would say that what you did was wrong.
No. I follow the dictates of my conscience. I follow the dictates of common humanity, decency, gratitude, compassion. That's what I tried to do. And I understand how complex the system is and how so many people can fall through the cracks and be denied what is rightfully theirs. And I made it my point during those 4 years in that capacity after Desert Storm that no one would have written on their tombstone that I died because of red tape and lack of care, and mostly lack of compassion of somebody who tried to use the system to create and allow what it was designed for.
Jim, I just got a question in from Ron in Raleigh. He said, could you have Jim explain why he believes vets and other active duty military continue to vote in large part for the people that don't give a damn about them? He's talking, I think, Jim, about the what we are told is the propensity of veterans in active duty to vote Republican.
That's a hard question to answer because many of these people are thoroughly imbued with the fact that the system is going to take care of them and that the Republicans are the ones who are in charge of that system or who are on the sides of that system, which, in fact, in many cases, they are not. I think it is through lack of information. It is through being imbued with a type of spirit of following leadership blindly, and of course they have to do, through the premise that the purpose of the military is not to practice democracy, but to protect it. The military is a non-democratic society.
Without a doubt.
And, of course, chains of authority and command are generally used to inculcate and to place in the minds of these young men and women that obedience to authority is necessary and that one day that authority will one day take care of them. I wish that were so, but in many cases it is not. And I think many of them will finish their careers and their lives, and when they go into civilian society, to realize that the things they were promised, sometimes and in many cases, are denied, and access to any type of help is so tied up in red tape and lack of caring. And while they vote Republican, what I've said previously is not a very good explanation.
Well, the military is by definition a very the
it's very conservative.
It's very authoritarian, and the Republicans also use an authoritarian power structure. Is it simply a matter of comfort zones?
In many cases, yes. Absolutely.
The Republican Party is very paternalistic, along with being authoritarian, and that to a certain extent the military is the same way, right?
Well, in many cases also, the Republican Party uses the military, and they use that type of...
They flog the bloody shirt better than anybody else on the planet.
Yeah, they do. And they, of course, use the military and that type of authoritarian system to create a situation in which people blindly obey. And, of course, in many cases, while they're in uniform, they have to. They have a different code of laws, USCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, and they begin to be possessed of that mindset. And, of course, the Republicans always come out in front of enlarging military expenditures and things of that nature. But the thing about it is, and what I've discovered, is the monies that the Republican parties wish to fund don't take care of people. They take care of defense contractors, and they take care of people who can build bigger and better and more powerful weapons. For example, the use of enriched uranium or shells and things of that nature. And these young men and women are sent into theaters of operation in which they are exposed to dangers of which they are unaware, Now, they're becoming more and more aware of it. They can't keep this thing hidden much longer. I mean, for example, in our war in Vietnam, Dow Chemical made a fortune with dioxin, Agent Orange, in order to defoliate the jungles of that country. And, of course, after the Vietnam War, when these people began to come home and they began to suffer from a number of maladies that go the entire medical spectrum in bag of horrors of what that drug or what those chemicals did, well, we see what happened. But the Republicans generally favor those corporations that make a lot of money off the war. And ultimately, and I hate to say this, and I say this with a lump in my throat, a poor man's war and a rich man, a poor man's fight and a rich man's war.
There you have it.
So there it is, and there you have it, as you said, and I hope that I have answered your friend's question. Not very well, because I don't pretend to be the fountainhead of all knowledge in these things. I've been involved in it, and I've tried to do the best I can to make people aware of the fact that anything you're going to get, you're going to have to fight for, and you're going to have to be able to use the system as best you can. Unfortunately, these people, in many situations, don't have the means in which to do it. As far as their political aspirations are concerned, we've talked about that. And there are a number of people in the military, I think, who've begun to realize that. And as long as the Republicans will represent some type of program that will offer them some type of promise as far as the improvement of care in military treatment facilities, veterans hospitals, things of that nature, they will continue to vote Republican. But in so many cases, the Republicans are speaking out of both sides of their mouths, as are many Democrats as well. It's just not Republican. It's Democrats, too.
Well, look, there's the... George started the Iraq War. George started the Afghanistan War. We're 2 years into the Obama administration, and he owns it now. The fact of the matter is, we don't begin to know, Jim, how many hundreds of thousands of returning veterans will have been maimed by this. I remember way back early in George's war when they were doing studies on depleted uranium, and they had a unit, a National Guard unit from Mississippi, I believe it was.
That's right, Bob.
And something like 70% of the offspring of that unit, when they came back and began having children, 70% of the offspring of that unit were flipper babies because of exposures to, among other things, depleted uranium.
Radiation. That's exactly right. They had a lot of deformities, things of that nature, a lot of maladies, a lot of children being born who were susceptible to any number of diseases, inflammations, that weren't normal. That's all there is to it.
And we have seeded the entire Mesopotamian region with that poison, and we have made our veterans sicker for having, because that stuff aerosolizes out of the breech of the artillery. God forbid you're in a tank and in an enclosed unit. You're going to breathe more of that stuff than you can even imagine. You know, it vaporizes when it hits the target, but it also vaporizes on the way out the, you know, down the lands of the barrel. And it comes out the back end on the breech when you go to eject the shell casing and insert another one.
Yes, it does. And in many cases, these people are unaware of the attendant harm of these weapons. But still, these weapons continue to be manufactured because of their efficiency and their ability to penetrate armor. And we could go on all night and talk about these things, and I can't do that.
I understand that, Jim. You have a good night, my friend.
And you too.
Bye now. Happy Veterans Day somehow seems inapropos. Reflective Veterans Day to you? Something like introspective Veterans Day to you? Yeah. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
You know, I really was going to take a break today, but I mean, I just, you know, this whole business with Obama, or at least his White House signaling that they're caving and then they're sort of trying to walk it back. I mean, how difficult is this problem? All they need to do is let them all expire and then introduce a tax cut for the group below $250,000 and, you know, watch the Republicans squirm.
Well, see, if you approach politics, Sandra, from a position of fearlessness, then that's exactly what you would do.
Well, you see, I mean, it just seems like that, and then it'd be like, you know, let them handle it. They're in power. Let them deal with saying no to a tax break to 90% of the population. You know, I mean, he doesn't have to be dealing with this at all right now. This is a thing that's really bugging the shit out of me.
And the reason it's bugging you is because you believe in that notion of politicking without fear. But they don't know how to message. I mean, can we reach that agreement, Sandra, that this White House hasn't a clue on messaging?
Well, yeah, and it's just bizarre because they let themselves get, for example, you know, I don't know what Obama thought he was doing when he sanctioned this commission. I've been thinking about that, too. I'm like, damn, that was another bonehead move. You know what I'm saying? It's absurd because he allows himself to be boxed in by all the treasury, but he contributes to it mightily by sanctioning this commission. It's incredible, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just watching it, it's just such a bad level of political theater. I have never seen anything so disastrous as watching this White House operate. And, you know, because they put that out there, yeah, of course, people are losing their minds over the thought of them capitulating, so now they're trying to walk it back. But guess what? We had this same song and dance with the public option, so of course I'm thinking that the fix is in. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
So, you know, it's hard for me to sort of, you know, fool me once. I'm not that. I look now. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I'm not down for the first fooling. Right.
This one looks to me, I'm assuming now because of how their past performance has been, I'm assuming now that, okay, this means they have capitulated. So they're just laying the groundwork to just sort of roll over completely, but they got to give us a little taste. Because I just think they're weak, man. I don't see no strategy, nothing. Just weakness through and through.
It makes me make, you know, caveman noises. Because, again, I'll ask what I've asked before. You get it, I get it, we get it, they don't. Why?
No, it's really ridiculous because when these tax cuts were approved, it was, you know, 10 years are up. Not only have they made out spectacularly well, we're in a crisis now. You have all the reasons in the world to say no. Either we extend the taxes for the taxpayers below 250, or we let them all lapse and we can start again in January.
But underlying all of this is this argument, and you can probably speak to this better than I can because you read more on it, this argument that I suspect is specious, that if these things just if these things just expire, that they will be the sole cause all the bread going stale and children talking back to their parents and the economy collapsing. Is there any evidence to support that, Sandra?
Well, no. I mean, the only argument you could make about some of the taxes is that because it's, you know, because of inflation and other whatevers, it may actually be quite a big increase for those under $250,000. But on the other hand, we're in really big trouble here if they're so concerned about deficits. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, oh yeah.
I don't understand why they're arguing about cutting taxes for the high income earners at the same time.
Well, is that then the answer to your question, that they want to come up with some answer to this because the people under $250,000 a year will get bitten on January 1?
Well, this is some of the arguments that I've heard, you know, because of the 10 years, I guess you can factor in whatever inflationary concerns. But I still think that they can, you know, introduce a tax cut now for those people under 250 and then let the Republicans vote that down.
Well, okay, then during the lame duck session, why not put through the tax cut for those making less than 250 and make those Republicans deal with it now in the lame duck session and then the rest of it expires?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. To, you know, introduce the tax bill that you want for the so-called middle classes. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I mean, we've still got the Democratic majority to pass it.
Right, and it's just sort of, you know.
I mean, is it simply that there does not exist time in which to get it through both houses?
I have no idea. I just don't really understand, you know, if it's all that crucial. They should be able to handle it right now. But we know what the situation is.
Well, I mean, are taxes by definition budgetary? And if so, can it be done in the Senate via reconciliation?
Well, that's what the Bush tax cuts were, actually. That's how they got passed.
So if Nancy and Harry sit down and say, we're going to work like fiends all the way up to midnight December 31st to get this done, then if Nancy could get it through in a week, then the Senate, using reconciliation, could get it through in a week and have done? And this is, you know, this is procedural and rule-based stuff and not philosophical or number-crunching. This is within the structure that is the Congress operating by its own rules. Can they get it done?
Well, the thing is, you know, I always think that's more of a political question, because obviously when that bill just sort of popped up on Obama's desk to make foreclosures easy, that didn't take very long to sort out. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
So it's not a question of, they need to have X amount of days to get something through. I just think that it's a matter of, we're going to get this done because this interest wants us to, so here it is. But in this case, the interest is all of us. But that never seems to be enough of a push, as we know. But personally, I sort of think that I think all those tax cuts need to just expire. I'm sorry. You know, at this point, I mean, the situation is such that where is the revenue going to come from?
And, you know, they don't, the right wing doesn't have any answers. I think that story about Kasich in Ohio saying, well, you know, I'm not going to build the railroad with the money, but I sure would like to keep it.
Yeah, well, no, it's incredible because, in the meanwhile, don't forget, I'm still, the quantitative easing, you know, that's still going on, which is, you know, can be really detrimental to us when the prices start going up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I just noted my gasoline was $3 a gallon again.
Yeah, and that, you know, that, don't think that that's operating in a vacuum. It could have serious implications for just regular folks if you keep debasing the dollar. But anyway, listen, did you hear about in Oklahoma, they want to use animal euthanasia drugs on people now?
No.
For the death penalty, yeah, because they, for some reason or the other, the drug they use for people is a bit too expensive.
No, because, wait, they're trying to execute on the cheap now?
Well, yeah, they're going to court next week to see if they can get the okay to use the same drug that I guess they put down hamsters. I mean, I don't know, man. Have no idea. But apparently there's a shortage. There's a shortage of the drug. That's what it is. And they need to kill people right quick. They can't wait. And they want to use something they put dogs down with.
Jesus. I generally hold that Texas gets the first place spot for insanity, but I think Oklahoma's given them a real battle for the trophy right now. Because are you following this? I mean, that's mind bending.
Well, it's just like, wow. I don't know. I mean, they keep some people on death row for so damn long. What's a few more months to wait for this particular drug to kill people with? I don't know.
But are you following all of the fallout from their patriotic, upstanding, good, God-fearing Christian vote to make sure Sharia law is never used in Oklahoma? Are you seeing what's coming out of that?
What's the latest? It passed, right?
It passed big.
Right, I mean, no, it was a huge pass, and I used to shake my head thinking, oh, glad to be in California. But anyway,
For instance, if you were a lawyer, say, arguing a case in Oklahoma, and you wanted to look at the jury and say, now, we're all God-fearing people here, and it says in the Ten Commandments that thou shalt not bear false witness. The other side now gets to stand up and say, I object. Counsel is arguing a point based upon foreign law. Move to strike. In other words, the good, fine, upstanding, God-fearing Christian voters of Oklahoma have just voted the Ten Commandments right out of their legal system because it's foreign law.
Okay.
Isn't that beautiful?
Listen.
And they've also just wiped out the entire legal structure of all of their Indian nations. Remember, there are more Native Americans in Oklahoma than in any other state in the Union.
Oh, right. Well, so what is the exact text of that law that passed then? I mean, I don't mean that you know it verbatim, but I mean, what is it saying?
Well, it says that no judge in the state of Oklahoma, in reaching a conclusion, can consider any foreign law, including but not limited to Sharia law.
So of course you can expand that right up. What? I don't mean to laugh because it's
no. Laugh, please, I find it delightful.
That's great. I mean, yeah.
You know, the next time the Oklahoma Citizens for Decency and Morality start themselves a let's get the Ten Commandments in the schools, I would pay money to be there just to see what happens when the judge looks at him and says, I can't do that. I'm not, you probably voted for this thing. This constitutional amendment says that I can't order foreign laws to be, well, it ain't foreign, it's Jesus. Sorry, he weren't American.
Oh, you know, I have to say, because there's so many friends of the horn that's, you know, all around the South. It's just like, wow, you know?
I hope that none of the right-wingers in places like Alabama, well, Miss Obama Seesaw, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, I hope none of them are paying attention to this, because I want some foreign law constitutional amendments there, too.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's a good one.
And then send the ACLU just marching through the South like Sherman going, Ten Commandments in the schools, get them out. You good, fine, upstanding, God-fearing Christians voted against foreign law, and you know what? Moses was not from Mississippi. Get them out. And watch the judge say, sorry, constitutional amendment that you people voted for says I got to do it.
Well, listen, the idiocy does not just stay down there. Did you hear what happened in New York?
No, which?
With Billionaire Berg. He just appointed some media executive to be the new chancellor of, like, the largest public school system in the country. Now, I'm sorry, if I had an engineering firm, would I hire a surgeon to run it?
No, and you know what? You don't want your local auto body guy doing your appendectomy either.
Right, so why is it that the children of New York, it's okay to subject them to some know-nothing corporate toady who's used to run? You know what I'm saying? And he didn't do, he made this announcement within 3 hours, apparently. So he's just a tyrant, and this fool has aspirations for the presidency. It makes me shudder, because he really is a plutocrat, because he goes to Bermuda to his half an island that he owns, and they have to clear out all the traffic before he shows up, Bob.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
So this is a real plutocrat, Mayor Bloomberg. And it's just kind of like, yikes. So I don't, you know, and she had the nerve to say, are we going to have to give me some time to get up to speed? It's like, wow.
Well, maybe you wouldn't need that kind of time to get up to speed if you actually knew anything about the educational process.
Right, and it's completely acceptable, I guess, in education to have people. I mean, they have to get a state waiver for this bitch to do her job, because apparently, brace yourself, you're supposed to have some sort of educational background by law to be the head of educational system. Anyway, that one just sort of did my head in, because I just thought, wow, we are just in trouble, and I just can't deal with these.
You know, I would just like to find any news story anywhere, Sandra, that doesn't have, some sort of lighter font color above the headline, further proof that we're really seriously in trouble, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, you know, of course, if you have any sense, you really need to focus on the movement of the rich that have come out of the shadow. They out. It's on.
And the bits in the teeth, absolutely. And they've got their heads and they're running hard. Cassie earlier in the evening with her email, you know, she puts forward a very serious question. How do you get a group of people, you know, 20, 21, 22 years old, who aren't even quite aware yet that someday they're going to die, to give a damn about the difference between getting your Social Security at 65 versus getting it at 69.
Well, oh, I know. And it's just sort of stunning because, once again, that segment of the population that will be brutalized by changes like this, you know, are just voiceless. I mean, i.e., these plutocrats who are on the commission. I'm sorry to keep falling on that, but it's just doing my head in, the zero representation that the vast majority of us have now on zilch.
And the thing is, it's been that way for a while, but they used to maintain this facade that we did.
Yeah, it was a facade, you know, and it was a facade. You know, you have the whole sort of, like I always talked about, that sort of inverted, totalitarianism. That's one thought. And then there's the sort of investment theory of politics. I mean, yeah, we're right there. We're here. We've arrived. And, yeah, I still think I think more people are much more aware of it, and it manifests itself differently. I think the foreclosure thing is a real wake-up call for people, you know. It's hard to miss.
Well, did you see, Sandra, this story about the judge in New York State?
What now?
He has caused a bit of a foo-fraw.
Because there's one that's been sort of like calling him on this shit, but is this a different one?
Well, no, I think this is that one. But the thing is, in the course of a foreclosure hearing, this judge disallowed something like $292,500 worth of foreclosure mortgage debt. Because it turned out that, like we've been talking about, the documents were all dummied up. Let's see. This story's a couple of days old. I found it over at Alternet. Headline, judge dismissed $292,500 in debt due to shady lender practices. Wall Street freaks out. Long Island Judge Jeffrey Spinner dismissed a foreclosure case last year because the paperwork was so haphazard. He called the lender's behavior repugnant, and he gave homeowner Diane Yano Horoski's he gave her her house back. And One West Bank is appealing, but it's got a lot of these fraudsters absolutely soiling themselves.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, see, that's the thing that of course the criminals, which is what they are, I'm sorry, are living in fear of. You know, if some pocket starts sort of resisting at that level where they say, well, too bad, you can't prove you own it, so you don't get it, and they just give it back to the person, and you get a lot of background noise about, oh, well, people shouldn't have free houses, and that's what they're counting on.
Well, but the other thing is, for as much a good news story as this is, Sandra, they buried the lead. Because this judge, Jeffrey Spinner, in the following paragraph, it says, the judge and his colleagues, which means other judges, like I gotta tell you, estimate that they've thrown out as many as half of the foreclosure cases in New York based on similar bad paperwork. Brooklyn and Long Island account for some of the state's highest rates of foreclosure, but the rulings could influence lower court judges across the country.
Yeah, no, I mean, but this is the thing that has to happen, though. I mean, there has to be some sort of response, and once again, the vacuum that is the White House, it's like, they're not doing anything about it. And I understand they can just sort of say, oh, it's more of a state, the state thing, but, no, that's a big deal. And I can imagine that Wall Street will be freaking out, and keep your eye on the new Congress to not come up with some remedy for them.
You mean like the notary thing that they tried to just quietly slip through and got all the way to the president's desk?
Yeah, some way of insulating them. I'm sorry, I see them figuring out some way to continue with their criminality because...
Well, I tell you what, I haven't seen this guy's name being bruited about, but he's apparently being a bit of a hero to the extent that a judge can be, this Judge Spinner. In his opinion about the One West foreclosure against the Yano Horoski family, he said that One West operated, and this is a quote, with an opprobrious demeanor and condescending attitude. He said he accused them of duplicity. That's fancy judge speak for lying in contradictory paperwork. He said that they filed their stuff past deadline. And he said that they repeatedly alleged different amounts due and owing from the borrowers.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's a complete mess. And one thing I've been leaving my eye on is Bank of America. They're in serious trouble. Their stock has lost 40% of its value since April. There's all sorts of different parties coming at them with lawsuits. And what that means for us is some sort of TARP 2.
Or TARP 3.
A gun to the head saying, if you don't, we're going to trash, you know, because that's the mode now. And they made the mistake of buying Countrywide, which they still won't recognize. Can you believe they can get...
Is that sort of reminiscent of... It reminds me of back when that business genius Count Dicula bought...
The asbestos.
Yeah, bought the asbestos manufacturer.
Yeah.
The board at Halliburton had to be... Hey, Dick, what are you doing?
No, it's the same thing, and it's bordering on the absurd and ridiculous because Bank of America is trying to say that Countrywide is still... solvent, and it's just like, huh? Anyway, they're in trouble, but they're so big now that they'll be like, you know, demanding some sort of relief from the taxpayers, and the madness just continues. And did you know that in Southern California, home values have fallen 40%? These are depression type numbers, okay?
But let me ask you this much. Those are depression type numbers, Sandra.
It was like 25-26% during the 30s, the values of home, and we had far less people owning them. So This is just.
How much of that 40% do you think is those values losing their inflated values? Do you see what I'm saying? You know, when a three-bedroom ranch style in San Diego goes for $1 million, you know, come on.
Oh, yeah, no. That's exactly, but the thing is, so what, though? People still were operating as if that was market value, not magic to market. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the wealth that's lost, you know, is still, you know, real, and the problem is there's no
Well, product. And it's more real, Sandra, because we're talking about people. We're not talking about the Chablis and Brie Lark's Vomit Canapé crowd. We're talking about the people whose primary source of wealth, their wealth equity, is resided in their house.
Yeah, and, you know, getting back to what people know and what they don't know, you know, you're getting a hard lesson here. For example, how many people do you think realize that second homes and yachts and boats and shit can be sort of crammed down and your primary home can't be? And that was a result of the 2005 law change in bankruptcy. I mean, you know, these are like hard-ass lessons because there is no way that is equitable in any...
And the Cat Food Commission touches on this too, Sandra, because one of their recommendations is to wholly eliminate mortgage interest write-off on tax forms. And that's all that the middle class had left to write off. Because with the Reagan tax dodge in the 80s, they took away being able to write off car interest, loan interest, the interest on credit cards.
Oh yeah, I know. That's right. You're right about that.
It's all the middle class had left.
No,
and it's another case of they want it all.
Yeah, they do want it all, and it's just stunning that they are actually looking at these poor-ass veterans and saying, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, we want to increase the copay and try to shift your ass to some sort of private situation. Did you catch that?
Yes, I did.
I mean, I'm like, ooh, wow, this is way out of control, but you still have to be insulted in the end with them wanting to reduce the tax rates on the top all the way to, like, 26% or something crazy.
When the effective tax rate of what they're paying already is near zero.
That's right. Nobody's right.
But how do they come up with this notion that it's revenue that it's not even revenue neutral? It's revenue positive.
No.
When the fact of the matter is that the things are still going to be in place for corporate America, and corporate America is still not going to pay taxes.
No, it's incredible, but it's just a lie. You know, we're still being inundated with this trickle-down shit. At the same time, the inventor of it all is all over TV saying that it's a lie. You know, Dave Stockman or whatever his name is.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him. And, you know, how sad has it gotten when David Stockman has to be the guy who slaps down Mike Pence?
Yeah.
I mean, I saw that on one of the Sunday programs. Are there no Democrats who have the brains to slap down Mike Pence? We've got to have old David Stockman there.
Oh, no.
But, I mean, that was a beautiful moment when he said the rich don't need a tax cut. And what followed, the rich don't deserve it.
No, and it's just like, hello? So, we get full circle back to the idea that the White House can't find their ass on this one. It's just amazing.
With both hands.
It's incredible, and it's just—I don't know—you know—it's beyond depressing, it really is. But anyway, I mean, that's, you know, my problem. I'm just sort of like, wow.
I really don't know. I thought that's nicely self-deprecatory of you, Sandra, but I don't think that's your problem.
Well, no, I just mean, you know, how they always say, my money's still, you know, you need an attitude adjustment, but it's definitely.
Well, did you catch any of the tempest in a teapot that went down today when the story came out, I guess it was over at Huffington Post or whatever, saying that President Not Sure had already buckled on...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, and they were walking away, but oh, why?
Robert Gibbs had, or maybe David Axelrod, or this is not news. That, no, he didn't. He's not open, no. There's no story here. Move along.
No, but of
these are not the tax cut compromising droids you were looking for.
No, but we know it is, though. See, I'm sorry, and also the, you know, so now all of a sudden we're being prepared for the soldiers being there until 2014. That was the latest I saw.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, you sent that along. And anyway, by the time we get to 2013, we'll talk about the soldiers needing to stay in Afghanistan till 2020. Why not?
But I don't know. I would think that at some point it's going to become too expensive for us. But, I mean, I don't know. Maybe not if they get that Social Security cut. And the thing is, a security cut will affect people like my mother, like right now, if they had their way, right?
Yes.
My mother's 72. She fucking worked hard all her damn life. I don't know. I'm just, all of it just makes me feel kind of queasy.
Well, I take it back to that bumper sticker. Maybe we need to, maybe this is a way for the horn to make money. Just a black bumper sticker with big white block letters. They want it all.
Right, but don't we need to put some sort of refug symbol somewhere?
Yeah, we'll put an elephant by it.
An elephant, okay, yeah, because, you know, because people have to have the whole picture drawn for them. Listen, are there some artists in the horn family?
There most assuredly are. Okay, here's how it is. It's black background, white letters, they want it all, and an elephant with a circle and slash through it.
Right, so maybe, you know, some of the more talented people can, like, you know, send some prototypes up.
Oh, by the way, Sandra wants to know, did you get your annotated bibliography finished? She says, I'm envious of you. My time in school is done, and they gave me the papers and sent me away.
Who's asking that?
That's Kate.
Oh, listen, it's never ending. But, yeah, I posted it on the Google Docs for the other freaks to gaze upon it and edit. Yes.
The other freaks. Those are your colleagues. Those are your colleagues, Sandra. You got to learn academic speak. You're never going to go anywhere.
No, when you're talking about strategic planning, my head, because I just wrote this whole paper on, brace yourself, environmental scanning for nonprofit organizations. Hello.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes. You know, so please, please, please. You know I'm straight up crazy, and that paper did not help.
Just wandering around alphabet. What'd you do when you got done? Went and alphabetized the cans in your shelf?
No, I now have to evaluate some sort of search engine. So no, it never ends.
Oh dear God.
Yeah.
Although there's a part of me that, like Kate, envies you.
You know, and listen, this is all just hiding out because there ain't no jobs and I got to do something. I'm sorry, because I don't want to stop.
Well, do you get thrown back into the classroom again? Or, I mean, are you teaching more? Or?
No, I haven't really hooked up any sort of teaching. I mean, I'm looking at a couple other options for the spring, but it's all sort of interny, kind of stipend-ish. You know, and I say that means nothing. The dollars, no dollars, you know.
Right.
Maybe they'll give me some crackers or something, but yeah, you know how it is.
I'll never forget my one. It was my grad school adventure in theater, and my work study job was to sit for hours per week up in the hottest part of the theater building at the University of Alabama, among literally old civil defense water barrels. and my job was to sign out props when people came for them. Yeah, nobody ever showed up. I was like the Joe character in Idiocracy. You know, that was just sort of hidden away, and it was hell. You know, it's a lot easier to be busy than it is to look busy.
Yeah, for sure. Well, no, I mean, you know, I mean, this program is interesting. I mean, I'm sort of looking now at like information architecture, which is fascinating. You know.
Oh, that is cool stuff. You know, the cloud and all of that business.
Yeah, just the tagging and the sort of leveling of the internet and anyway, the semantic web. You know, it's all real. It's all
well, you'd probably enjoy the latest posting from our buddy Joe Bagent, who notes that he was talking with some really brilliant young Italian students in Italy, and he said. He said, sitting in a trendy wine bar, one of those that brings out food to match your particular choice of wine, mystified by the table setting, what was that tiny baby spoon for? Cappuccino, surely, at some point, but why no big spoon to go with the knife and fork? The things a redneck American does not know grow exponentially in Bella Italia, starting with the restaurants, but then they whacked him. He said, one thing the Italians can never be accused of is being culture given to vinyl-sided sameness fast food franchises. Another thing, though, is a lack of a good educational system, given that Italy's is among the very best in the world. So here I am. This is the fun part. This is what you said reminded me of. So here I am sitting with some college kids trying to hang on to my end of a discussion of evolutionary consciousness and whether Italy can withstand the cultural leveling of globalism. And, you know, knowing Joe, it had to just be the question. And, Mr. Bajant, what do you think of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin's concept of the hive mind and the noosphere? Can monolithism and totalitarianism possibly be resisted in the cybernetic age?
Shut the heck up. Oh, boy. What is he over there on, some sort of book tour?
Yeah, he's promoting the new book. Out in the rest of the world, it is being sold as Rainbow Pie.
When is it here, though?
I haven't gotten an answer to that. I know it's out in Australia. He's been down there. He's been all over
Amazon?
Europe. It's Amazon Britain, Amazon UK. You can find excerpts and reviews of Rainbow Pie. When it comes out in the U.S., it will come out as Shanghai Road. And this is my name-dropping brush with greatness moment. I got to read The Galleys. Holy cow, you want this book.
No, definitely.
Mm. Yeah, because I hope to get Joe on to talk about it, but I can...
Oh, yeah. Wow, that would be you gotta send a tweet out for that interview.
But I can just, I can imagine, let's see. Do all those disassociated shards of human input constitute an overarching hive intelligence, or are they the emergence of further evolutionary structures? Joe writes his answer as follows. Timothy Leary once convinced me that they are, I said. But after the drugs wore off, I wasn't so certain. And now I'm certain again that he was right, but with a far more chilling outcome than he or Chardin could have ever predicted. And he says, which was pretty good for pulling it out of my ass.
Shut the hell up. Yeah, that's a pretty good answer to that dribble that he was getting. Well, listen, let me let you move on.
All right, thank you, Sandra. Wonderful conversation.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye now.
Bye.
The hive mentality and how to resist. You know what? That's actually we kid and we joke, but that's actually a legitimate question. How do you resist totalitarianism in the cybernetic age? Because everything gets leveraged, right? It kind of does. So keep an eye out. I don't know when what will be called here Shanghai Road will be released, but it's a stunner. It is a sure enough dandy. And I hear from Joe every now and then, he writes, drops me a note and tells me, still alive, hope you are, that kind of thing. But all of this points toward, like I said with Sandra, it seems like every news story should have a header over it, further proof that we're in the soup. Aren't we? Yeah. By the way, I got an email in I got an email in pointing me to a website called Congress Matters and an article by David Waldman. Last congressional working session, reconciliation is still a live option. So, yeah, theoretically, some of this stuff could be dealt with in the last couple of weeks of this session. Or the last month or so. And God knows. Well, God knows, but do they? Do they know, these Democrats, that their hopes of returning to power someday hinges on what they're willing to do in these last 2 weeks? Yeah, I don't know. Lines are open. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. There's tons of stories, and I don't know. Well, this is one of those, hey, isn't it fun to be out in front of the curve stories? Because you and I agreed a long time ago, a couple of weeks ago, when they first started leaking out little bits and pieces of Georgia's dim leader's new book, Decision Pants, you and I were ahead of the curve in saying, you know, it's time to have a real criminal investigation. Guess who it turns out we were ahead of? This, according to Reuters, Dateline London. The United States must prosecute former President George W. Bush for torture if his admission in a memoir that he authorized waterboarding holds true, rights group Amnesty International said on Wednesday. In Decision Points, published this week, Bush defended his decision to authorize waterboarding, a form of simulated drowning condemned by some as torture. Oh, stop with the weasel language. Stop. Condemned by some as torture. Come on, Reuters! Come on! It's not condemned by some as torture. It is universally acknowledged by everybody except the torturers that it is torture. Come on! Please! Amnesty International Senior Director Claudio Cordone said in a statement, under international law, anyone involved in torture must be brought to justice, and that does not exclude former President George W. Bush. If his admission is substantiated, the USA has the obligation to prosecute him. In the absence of a U.S. investigation, other states must step in and carry out such an investigation themselves. I agree. And the sooner the international investigations begin, the better, because if nothing else, I want George W. Bush to be a prisoner in his own country. You know, we talked last night about the intimidation of citizens who are not even suspected of having committed a crime when they come back into the United States from abroad because of abuses that are contained within the Patriot Act. I would like very much for George W. Bush, who has done much more evil, who has unleashed much more hell on this planet than anybody who merely helped set up a website for a young man incarcerated in conjunction with the WikiLeaks case. He's done so much more evil. And he needs to be subjected to the same law. The blood on the ground cries out for retribution as it did with murdered Abel of old. It would be nice to have a list of countries, to know that there are countries out there that George W. Bush dare not visit. And I would like them to be countries that are respectable, that make themselves respectable by such a finding. The UK, Australia, Japan, Spain, France, Germany. Be kind of fun if it could be some South American countries, too. Maybe Paraguay. Remember right before he was leaving office, the Bush family bought a bunch of land in Paraguay up by the Bolivian border? Yeah, let's. Maybe Bolivia could do that, too. George Bush directly approved the use of torture and stained this country forevermore by doing so. But this ought not come as any sort of a surprise to anyone involved in the process, anyone paying attention. This is just part and parcel of the whole story of George W. Bush's miserable, benighted, psychopathic, sociopathic existence on this planet. News story. Dateline Dallas, Associated Press. A DNA test on a strand of hair has cast doubt on the guilt of a Texas man who was executed 10 years ago during George W. Bush's final months as governor. The case was that of a liquor store robbery and murder. Claude Jones is dead now. Claude Jones was executed under the signature of George W. Bush. Claude Jones may have well been innocent. A single hair. Imagine that. A single hair was the only piece of physical evidence. The only piece. One tiny hair that linked Claude Jones to the crime scene. But there's a problem. Jurors were told that it was Claude Jones's hair, and that that placed him at the crime scene. It wasn't. Thorough DNA analysis has discovered that the hair was not Jones's, but instead likely came from the murder victim. Now, it's a far cry from saying that an innocent man was put to death, but we are talking about Texas, and we are talking about the governorship of George W. Bush, when people were put to death while he laughed. Had you forgotten? While he laughed. Do you remember? Do you remember the woman who everyone said had been rehabilitated, had dedicated her life to Christ, was a shining example of the rehabilitative possibilities behind the hellish prison walls in Texas? And they sought clemency for her. Not that she be released from prison, but merely that she, her sentence be commuted from one of murder by the state to simple life in prison without possibility of parole. And George Bush refused. And then later, talking to friends, laughed about it, made sport of her, made fun of her.
There she was. Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. Well, you're going to fry, sister. We're going to kill you.
You see, there is a greater tragedy in this. Claude Jones was not a nice person, but that's, you know, you don't go to trial on murder based on whether you're a nice guy or not. He was a career criminal. But Claude Jones did maintain all the way to the end his innocence in killing the liquor store owner. He was executed by lethal injection on the 7th day of December 2000. As it came closer and closer to the time for him to be horizontally crucified by the state of Texas, he begged, he pleaded, not to be turned loose, but simply to be allowed to do a DNA test of the one lonely, solitary hair that prosecutors said was his and had no damned proof that it was. He sought a reprieve for the testing. But in the briefing papers that were given to the murderer-in-chief, no one told Dim Leader that he was requesting that DNA testing. Not that it would have mattered. George W. Bush is a giggling, psychopathic murderer. Barry Scheck, the head of the Innocence Project, said, "It is absolutely outrageous that no one told him that Claude Jones was asking for a DNA test. If you can't rely on the governor's staff to inform him something's really wrong with the system, save your breath." Save your breath, Barry Scheck, because all that you needed to say is, something is really wrong with the system. A spokesman for the giggling murderer would not comment for the story. This is a hell of a case. The evidence that Claude Jones was the killer came from one of the two alleged accomplices in the case, a man named Timothy Jordan. Timothy Jordan didn't go in the liquor store. It was thought, however, that he had planned the robbery and provided the gun. He testified that Claude Jones told him he was the trigger man, that he told him he was the trigger man. But under Texas law, you can't be convicted solely on the testimony of an accomplice. There has to be other evidence. And the only evidence was that lone, thin, fine, solitary hair. And the giggling murderer sent him to his death. Tough one to swallow, isn't it? It is for me. Meanwhile, also arising out of Texas, the stories of, it's not much, but it's just, you know, another one of those things where we write above the headline, further evidence that we're in the soup. Two members of Congress are Representatives Solomon Ortiz and Ruben Hinojosa. They were walking down the hall in one of the congressional office buildings recently. They are both Democrats. Oh, not Solomon Ortiz, I'm sorry. Representative Ruben Hinojosa and Congressman Sylvester Reyes, both Democrats, were walking down the hall when five teabaggers came up. Hinojosa said there were five men, all white. They looked at Sylvester Reyes and said, "Are you a congressman?" He said, "Yes, I'm from Texas." "Are you both congressmen?" To which Ruben Hinojosa says, "Yes, I am a congressman too." At which point they looked at him and said, "Why don't you go back to Mexico?" Hinojosa, being asked about it, said, "It was an insult. It shows the extra challenges those of us who want change, who want to improve the quality of life for women and minorities, have." "Why don't you go back to Mexico?" These are older gentlemen. They probably couldn't take on five vicious, violently inclined, godforsaken teabaggers. But Lord, how tempting would it be to say, "Why don't you go back to Scotland and Ireland and England and France and Germany, you teabagging ass? Why don't you go back to Mexico?" See, that's the trouble you get into when you start fooling around with artificial borders and boundaries. There's DNA that flows through both Congressman Hinojosa and Congressman Reyes's bloodstreams. There's DNA that flows through them that's been running around this half of the globe for the last 20,000 years. "Why don't you go back to Mexico?" Jiminy. Ron just wrote in a little bit ago, and he said, with regard to the school story that Sandra was talking about, "I have no doubt that that she will run the school system like a business." That's their mantra, isn't it? "We're going to run this like a business. We're going to run this like a business, and we're going to run right into the ground." Jiminy. By the way, by way of keeping up, a couple of stories. That was teabaggers in D.C. talking to two congressmen from Texas. "Why don't you go back to Mexico?" "Well, I take you now to Tennessee." Tennessee has a state-run health insurance program. They were having hearings about it in legislative meetings. The program is called Cover Kids. And he was asking questions of a witness about and followed. Tillicum would have been put out of everyone's misery back in 1991 and would not have had the opportunity to claim two more human lives. What about the term killer whale do SeaWorld officials not understand? Says the ancient civil code of Israel, when an ox gores a man or woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner shall not be liable. That's Exodus 21:28. Jesus. So, I mean, this is the kind of stupid crazy that this guy engages in. Like this kind of stupid crazy.
I've never called gay people terrorists. Although I've said that what they have done is like domestic terrorism. You've got these mujahideen on the battlefield setting out these syringes with the HIV virus in it as a way to carry out terrorism. But this is exactly what happens when two males have sex with one another. If one of them is HIV positive, then it's just like injecting his partner with a needle with HIV. That's domestic terrorism. I don't know what else you call it.
Yep. Gay people are domestic terrorists. More particularly, people with HIV are domestic terrorists. Well, now, the American Family Association's Brian Fisher is bent out of shape at the Bears. Oh, look, he's having a go at the Bears! One human being is worth more than an infinite number of grizzly bears. Another way to put it is that there is no number of live grizzlies worth one dead human being. If it's a choice between grizzlies and humans, the grizzlies have to go. And it's time. Can we start with the mama grizzly, Mr. Fisher? Just asking. God makes it clear in Scripture that deaths of people and livestock at the hands of savage beasts is a sign that the land is under a curse. Except in Job. We talked about Job, didn't we? Yeah, we talked about... Yes, we did. We talked about Job. Because in that case... savage beasts attacked the flocks and folds and the herds and whatnot, and God said it was okay to do that, even though Job was a good and righteous man. God makes it clear in Scripture that deaths of people and livestock at the hands of savage beasts is a sign that the land is under a curse. The tragic thing here is that we are bringing this curse upon ourselves.
Cuckoo, 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 cuckoo.
This guy wants to stone whales. So when he goes to stone the whale, and he throws the rock, and it skips just like Andy and Opie out to the fishing hole, is that a sign that God rejects the stone? I'm just asking. I mean, these are complex theological debates, right? In a piece in the L.A. Times which exudes... Why is it these... homophobes are always talk about exuding and injecting. I don't know. Dr. Freud, latency phone. Dr. Freud, latency phone. In a piece in the L.A. Times which exudes far more compassion for live bears than dead people, writer Julie Cart wrings her hands over the 48 grizzlies that have died this year in the Yellowstone region this year. I read it that way. He wrote it that way. Don't blame me. On top of the 52 which died last year, now two people have also died, which barely rates a mention in her column. In fact, her opening sentence oozes. See, we're exuding, injecting, and now we're oozing. Homophobes, what are you going to do? Oozes with sympathy for these poor, misunderstood creatures. It's been a bad year for grizzly bears, and if forecasts prove correct, it's only going to get worse. It's not until the fifth paragraph that we get the first mention of a human fatality, and it's only in passing, in words from a man who lost a friend to a grizzly and naturally blames people, apparently including his own botanist friend. A grizzly is a top-level carnivore. At times he will act like one, said Chuck Neal, author of Grizzlies in the Mist, who lost a botanist friend to a grizzly attack this year. People are readily available source of high-quality protein. We eat too much and exercise too little. We're like a hot dog on two legs. Yep, says this freak. Yep, The problem is those pesky couch potato homo sapiens who just need to get in better shape so they can, what, outrun a bear? The other culprit, of course, is climate change, since Julie apparently believes the fantasy that people are to blame for that. Well, there you have it. Oh, this goes on and on and on. I could have done a whole hour on this story alone. Grizzly bears. Grizzly bears. God is sending America a plague of grizzly bears. I'll agree it's a plague if we include the mama grizzly. Yeah. Jesus. Stupid. It hurts. And by the way, Kate sent a note along. Jim, if you're still listening, Kate says, thank you, Jim. You answered the listener's question just fine. In all my years, I've never met a liberal Democrat in uniform. Maybe one or two. I did 12 years as a dependent wife and 2 decades as an advocate. I wish there'd been more like you when I was working with returning vets at Fort McCord and Fort Lewis in the 70s. We so badly needed advocates with morals back then. Thanks for your service and the service you provide to the Horn listeners, including your historical knowledge. The music of your accent causes me to miss my time east of the Mississippi. Thank you, Kate. That was awfully kind. So we find ourselves at the end of the program. We'll be back tomorrow night for Friday on the Front Porch. On his way, coming up next, live from Pennsylvania behind the Scrapple Curtain, my good friend and colleague Rick Smith with the Rick Smith Show. 3 solid hours of some of the best liberal talk you're going to hear in the country today, period, bar none. So, by all means, feel free to stick around. Thanks to those of you who are kindly contributing to keep things going here. We are at the 11th day of November, 4 days away from the halfway point of the month, and we try to raise $2,500 a month, and we are nowhere near $1,250. We're a lot closer to 700 than we are to 1,200. You'll have that. But thank you for those of you who are trying. Every little bit helps. There's a PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. The snail mail address is also there for those of you who prefer to work that way. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Thanks to Lottie in the chat room, our moderator there. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. My head writer is David in Tennessee. Our op-ed columnist is Reverbo, Cavalcade of Crazy at headonradionetwork.com. Matt Osborne at osborneinc.com is our Southeast correspondent. He had a great piece up about Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the Marine Corps yesterday at Crooks and Liars. You can probably still scroll down and find it. It's worth the read. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer, webmaster, web designer, head musician, the only musician, audio designer, show host, and guy who helps me. Well, there wouldn't be a horn without John Fox for all he does. Neither would there be a horn without Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Ben Birch, literally, if you go back and just wander around WhiteRoseSociety.org, and I encourage you to do this, Ben Birch literally made it possible for liberal talk to exist on the internet when he formed the White Rose Society. That's 8 years ago now. That's sticking to it. That's why I call him the hardest working man in liberal talk. WhiteRoseSociety.org. The only way that you can get horn programming. Thanks continue to go out to my good friends and colleagues at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. They are the hardest working, bravest people I know. Truly they are. coalriverwind.org, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.